This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Black political power is declining in the South, and this trend has damaging consequences for African-American communities. That's the thesis of a recent cover story in The New Republic called The New Racism: This Is How the Civil Rights Movement Ends. It argues that the decline of black political power is connected to the increased polarization of political parties and the disappearance of white Democrats. It also outlines key pieces of federal legislation that limit the efficacy of black political power. We're joined now by the essay's author, Jason Zengerle. He's senior editor for The New Republic. Jason, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the impetus behind this article.
I saw a study by someone named David Bositis who was tracking the number of African-American legislators in the South who belong to a majority party there in their state houses. And he found, you know, for a number of years, Democrats controlled these state houses and African-American legislators were Democrats. And because of that, these members had a fair amount of influence. You know, they were chairmen of very important committees. They had a lot of seniority. They held a lot of sway. You wouldn't necessarily have heard of them in Washington, D.C., but, you know, in Montgomery, Alabama, Jackson, Mississippi, places like that, they mattered. As the South has gone more Republican, though, over the years, and as Republicans have taken over these state houses, these black legislators have become minority members of their bodies, and they've lost their chairmanships. They've lost their seniority. I think Bositis had a figure where I think in 1994, something like 99% of black state legislators were in the majority in the South. By 2010, I think it was 50%, and today it's less than 5%. So it's just been a really dramatic decline. And I saw those numbers, and I wanted to sort of see how it actually looked on the ground. So Alabama seemed like a place where it happened very recently. 2010 was when Republicans took over the state house there. So I went to Alabama and spent some time with some of the black legislators there and was able to sort of, you know, tell their stories, which kind of trace the narrative arc of this happening.
Including Hank Sanders, who is a pretty good example of an individual who tells you that story. And
yeah, I mean,
history, yeah?
Sanders lived, I mean, his life is basically the story. He grew up in the Jim Crow South, managed to, you know, overcome extreme poverty, racism, eventually got to Harvard Law School, decided to go back to the South after graduating from Harvard and, you know, continue in the civil rights movement as a lawyer, eventually ran for office himself, became a state senator, and really became kind of a deal maker in Montgomery. I mean, you know, he came in, I think, thinking he was going to lead a revolution, realized very quickly that wasn't the case, realized he was going to have to, you know, get along with some of these white Democrats who, you know, oftentimes were still pretty racist. But he managed to form coalitions with them. And in the process, he became a real power broker. He eventually was the chairman of the committee that controlled the largest state budget. And as such, you know, he was in some ways more powerful than the governor, people said.
Those coalitions are important and striking. Remember the Democratic Party, yes, it's a one-party system down here in the South, but the Democratic Party is the party of massive resistance and leading the segregationist movement. So forming those alliances with unwilling partners. And so how did that come about? Because they weren't necessarily – they didn't stop being racist but understood politically the importance of –
Yeah, I think they both sides realized it was in their self-interest. And these white Democrats, you know, increasingly were going to need black votes to get elected. And Sanders, and there are other people in Alabama. There was a guy named Joe Reed who was very good at this. They were able to deliver those black votes. And Sanders' goal, Reed's goal, was to maximize black political power. And sometimes that meant endorsing white candidates over black ones if they thought that would get them a better deal in the end. And you know, eventually you didn't often have biracial coalitions at the polls, but in the state house, you actually did have these fairly effective biracial coalitions of white legislators and black legislators teaming up, working together. These were all Democrats, of course. And, you know, it was Alabama. I mean, it's a conservative state. It wasn't going to become Massachusetts overnight, but they were able to, you know, pass legislation and disperse resources in such a way that, you know, benefited African Americans. They are often poor African Americans who traditionally didn't really have much of a voice in the state capital.
So there's the trajectory, the increase in black political power in the South over that period. And as you cite the statistic, you go from 1994, 99%, over 99% in the majority to less than 5%. And this includes a period when an African American man is elected president of the United States. So what happened?
Well, I think in some ways that's part of the story, certainly in Alabama. You know, Obama gets elected in 2008, and up until then, there'd been a fairly recent tradition in the state where white voters would, you know, vote for Republicans in presidential races, vote for Republicans in gubernatorial contests, but when it came to their state legislative races, they would still vote for Democrats. After 2008, after Obama was elected, you know, I think 88% of white Alabamans voted for McCain in 2008. They loathed Obama. The state legislative races in 2010, the Republicans decided to make the races about Obama. I mean, they nationalized these state legislative campaigns, and as such, that history, that tradition of ticket splitting ended. And white voters in Alabama voted for Republicans, and they wiped out the Democratic majority in such a way they actually achieved supermajorities in both the House and the Senate, ending, I think, 134 years of Democratic majorities there.
Well, at this point in the conversation, I want to introduce UNC Chapel Hill Law Professor Kareem Creighton. His scholarship focuses primarily on the relationship between race, law, and politics. Kareem Creighton, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So you demonstrate these trends in federal elections, and of course we've just recently seen the evisceration of the voting rights law, and the legal theory there is, look, it was good for its time, but it served its purpose. It did precisely what it was meant to do, and therefore we don't need it, and that was the legal argument about that.
Indeed. I think the court gave us a pretty narrow conception of what the Voting Rights Act was all about, which was to give African Americans a guaranteed ballot. And once they could get to the polls and elect people to office, that was the end of the story. And I think what Jason described earlier is some of the success of what a lot of these members did once they got into office. But what I think got missed in all of this is the fact that there needs to be sustained oversight. A lot of that was able to occur because federal power was exerted to make sure that states would abide by those rules and make sure that African Americans, Latinos in this part of the country were actually getting a fair shake in redistricting, for example. And once the federal government withdrew those powers from the voting rights sphere after Shelby County, where the Supreme Court basically eviscerated Section 5, states reverted to form. And partly because of politics, partly because of a particular view about state power, decided to basically undercut most of the advancements that have been made over the last 20 or 30 years.
Why did that happen? Because, you know, you think about this. If you think about Sanders' coalition with white Democrats, the idea that we understand what power sharing is, and they both – doesn't that build a kind of institution that should support racial equality going forward? Why do they revert?
Well, I think the explanations are probably complex, but it probably has partly to do with political contestation between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans over the same period of time became pretty much the dominant party, as Jason described, here in the South. And their interest in gaining greater power involved taking power away from the Democratic Party. And they understood that the way in which Democratic politics works is by coalition. And so undercutting the coalition meant getting political power. There's also some element of it that involves disliking federal power, the use of federal intervention, which, you know, easily traces back to the 1960s, if not the Reconstruction. And so I think all of those things come together. In addition, of course, money. One of the things that happened in 2010 was that we had the influx of outside money in ways that we hadn't seen in earlier times. And Republicans were very good at pulling in outside money to wage war in a lot of these state legislative races. All of those things, I think, came together and made a huge shift. As in Alabama, North Carolina shifted after their redistricting to a supermajority for Republicans in both houses, which also hadn't existed since the Reconstruction period.
Well, and as we said, the narrative that was persuasive in the court argument is that there is no longer a need, that attitudes have shifted. And yet your research cites other research that suggests otherwise, that looks at racial attitudes, particularly in those Section 5 areas, and says perhaps we still need oversight. Tell us about that.
That's right. Again, the Supreme Court focused, the majority at least, focused primarily on increases in ballot casting, registration turnout, and office holding. And what we argued was that there are underlying elements that are just as important, if not more so, in the way politics work, like the way people think about race and politics, because those are the views that inform how people make choices of candidates. And when you look at the differences between places where Section 5 was applied as compared to other parts of the country, which is the factor that justice, the Chief Justice seemed to be concerned about, at least initially, you see huge differences. So if you look, for example, at places where you see white voters register more frequently evidence of intent to show bias between blacks and whites or other groups who are non-white, it's much more prevalent in the South. The best example I can offer in politics itself, though, is a comparison in the 2008 election between the states of Utah, which is heavily Republican, and Georgia. Roughly the same percentage of white voters in both states say that we're Republicans. So party, of course, is a factor. But when you look at the extent to which each of them supported the Democratic nominee, first African-American, Utah was ahead of Georgia. That is, more whites in Utah thought they would support the president, the presidential candidate for the Democrats, than Georgia. So there's probably something more than just party that's going on. And that's the argument we made to the court.
Well, Jason, as we look at the rise of the Republican Party in the South, I mean, to what extent, it has to be fair to ask, is it due to failed Democratic policies? The Democrats just weren't good at governing, and the people said, let's get rid of them and put somebody else in there.
I think that definitely is part of the story. It's certainly the story in North Carolina and in Alabama both. I think, you know, in North Carolina, the Democratic Party had, one, was not very good at winning elections anymore, and two, you know, they had become very corrupt. I mean, you had a number of legislators, including, I think, the Speaker of the House, going to jail. In Alabama, the Democratic governor went to jail. I mean, the Democrats gave the Republicans the opportunity. I mean, certainly the election of Obama was a big factor, but, you know, I think if the Democratic parties in either state had been a little bit more, you know, together and with it, they could have withstood this challenge, even if it just came to recognizing the threat. I mean, it was remarkable how national Republicans realized how important an election 2010 was in terms of gaining control of the redistricting process, and they spent just a ton of money on these state legislative races with the idea that they would control the maps, and Democrats were AWOL. They were nowhere to be found, and, you know, I think now Democrats realize that, and I was reading an article the other day on MSNBC about, you know, they have a plan for 2020, and it's actually in some ways more important election than 2016, and they're going to spend a lot of money in these state legislative races because they realize they need to do that to control the maps, but they're going to be 10 years late. I mean, Republicans are going to spend a lot of money in 2020 as well.
The Republicans did it right. They were ready for 2010 and got control of the map, and you point to a failed effort at or kind of miscalculation at redistricting on the part of Democrats in Alabama that also played into this.
Yeah, and that actually is an important part of the story. I mean, I think that for a long time there was sort of an unholy alliance between white Republicans and black Democrats in the South, where white Republicans saw the advantage of packing African-American voters into these black majority districts, and some of the African-American legislators wanted that themselves because it made their elections, you know, all but re-elections all but guaranteed. It made it so much easier. And they went along with these gerrymanders. I mean, they, you know, initiated them in a lot of instances because they actually controlled the process. I think after 2010, and some recognize this even before 2010, but after 2010, it's definitely dawned on them that packing African-American voters into these African-American districts, what it does is it ultimately harms white Democrats. And without white Democrats to partner with, they themselves have no power. So
because they were counting on those black votes in those districts. Mm-hmm. When you take them all away, they become more vulnerable.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's another legal argument that I think is pretty interesting, Kareem. And it comes up in the case of New Haven. Was it New Haven, Connecticut? We're in the Ricci case. And maybe if you could kind of summarize that for us in a way that poor old Frank could understand, I think that would be very helpful to see how this argument plays out.
Well, there's a lot going on in that case. But the main part that becomes relevant, I think, for this conversation is the city of New Haven decided after getting some information about some problems of an employment qualification exam to adopt a new one. And part of it was to avoid liability under civil rights statutes. And what some of the white, I think they were firefighters at the time, who had taken the earlier version of the exam were concerned about was that they would not necessarily have the ability to get advancement in rank as they otherwise would have under this new version of the exam, and said, you know, we think that this violates our 14th Amendment equal protection rights. Some people would refer to this as sort of reverse affirmative or reverse discrimination or affirmative action going sort of in excess. And the Supreme Court agreed with the white firefighters by saying that the city had sort of overreached in changing a test merely because of the threat of a civil rights lawsuit. And indeed, they thought that the underlying concern raised by a lot of civil rights actors was sort of exerting more authority than they were due over the political process, and so that there was something unsavory about a system that was too responsive to minority interest. And I argue in a piece that essentially that's the kind of thinking that sort of underlies the court's mistrust, in my view, of the way in which minority groups who fashion a space for themselves in the political process that maybe isn't consistent from their perspective with what the 14th Amendment adopts. And I think it underlies why they are so unhappy with the use of the Voting Rights Act, that in their view, minorities may be getting more than they're due using these statutes, particularly when there isn't evidence from their perspective that there continues to be the kinds of discrimination that continues to exist in the Section 5 states. The main point, though, I think that the dissent brings up in the case, and again, we follow up in a similar argument, is this is in some ways what politics is about. No one gets everything that they want all the time, but the idea of coalition building is to have a partnership, and sometimes you will get more than you may be due, and sometimes you get less. And that's what the court, I think, doesn't appreciate.
So by rejecting this, or by siding with the white firefighters here and saying, well, this minority group had an influence on the political process, you're suggesting, well, that's what happens a lot. I mean, if there's a tax cut that's passed and it only affects and helps a minority of taxpayers, then, well, that's how the political process works. Sometimes that happens. And if you build the proper coalition, your minority can work with the majority to get what it wants. So in the big view, that's how things work. But in this case, the court said, the minority shouldn't have influenced public policy.
Indeed. And I think that is even more surprising given what we all know, which is that we are inheriting a political system in which non-white groups, particularly in the South, got nothing. They had no representation at all in state legislatures, and the state legislatures themselves were sort of organizing around the principle of keeping out these political interests. So having a balanced relationship at this stage and a federal system that tries to protect that doesn't seem inconsistent with what the Constitution would permit.
The other interesting statistic when you look at it in terms of saying whether or not Section 5, whether or not this oversight should remain under the Voting Rights Act, is the number of states or which states have voter ID legislation and which states don't.
That's right. Another distinction that shows that something different is going on in the Section 5 states is that these kinds of qualification devices are more frequently found in Section 5 states than elsewhere. So when the Chief Justice looks for some reasoned difference between these areas where Section 5 coverage is found, you can look at issues like voter ID. And again, this is an issue that people on the other side would say, well, it isn't necessarily unconstitutional to do it. But when you look at the effect on minority populations, it's hard to deny that these aren't rules that take into account the real effects of a lot of these communities and what they wouldn't want as part of state policy.
And Jason, when we get back to party politics and you look here at North Carolina and again talk about the deficiencies of the Democratic Party, what role do you think Moral Monday and the NAACP in this state have played and whether or not they kind of confirm some of that suspicion?
Yeah, I mean, I think they really confirm the deficiency of the Democratic Party in the sense that they've kind of replaced the Democratic Party. I mean, first of all, they're happening because of legislation the Republican legislature is passing. So it's protesting this legislation they don't like. And then, you know, more to the point, like the Democratic Party in the state is not capable of sort of mounting a challenge to it itself. So it's sort of, you know, the NAACP and William Barber have kind of stepped into this void, in this vacuum. And I don't think the NAACP is even that big an organization in North Carolina. I mean, that's what's so remarkable, that it's been able to mobilize these people with not that much of an infrastructure. But, you know, the Democratic Party in the state is just in such a shambles right now that it really has fallen to this outside group to do this, that normally the party would do it.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Jason Zengerle, senior editor at The New Republic, author of the recent cover story, The New Racism, and also UNC law professor Kareem Creighton. Thank you both. Great to have you on the program.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, a Kuwaiti artist who makes art inspired by political controversy. Stay tuned.